All right, hi everybody. I'm here today with Sybil, Tom, and Krista. Hi everybody, thank you for joining me today. So Tom, Sybil, and Krista are members of the Ontario Brain Institute, and one initiative of the Brain Institute is something called ONDRI. And I was wondering if you guys could talk a little bit about where the genesis of this Ontario Neurodegenerative Disease Research Institute came from.
Well, the ONDRI network was standing for the Ontario Neurodegeneration Research Initiative. It's a long, complicated acronym, but there it is. Sort of solidifies around several of the themes that we talk about at OBI, and the major one has to do with collaboration. So it's a pan-Ontario network of motivated researchers and clinicians and patient groups and commercial enterprises. So we have several important sort of ways we do science rather differently with a goal of improving brain health for Ontarians. First of all, is that this is pan-Ontario, which means all the major groups that are working in this area within Ontario are working together on a common platform, sharing data, open science principles, using standardized methods so they can be shared not only between one another, but also internationally, and on a common data platform, which will facilitate some of the values of the second major theme, which is big data. So the idea is to be relatively agnostic as to what data sets you must acquire, and acquire pretty well everything as much as you can, because there are some very interesting data-driven strategies to try to sort out what some of the major themes are. The ONDRI group in particular is trying to resolve the fact that dementia is not a single disorder, right? There's a broad spectrum of disorders that can result in a symptom set which we call dementia, primarily related to cognitive issues and memory issues, some of which can be fairly clean and are typically called Alzheimer's disease, others that can be associated with other phenomena such as tremor and Parkinson's and some of the other motor phenomena. But the idea is to be relatively agnostic to the name of the disease and enter patients into a program which uses a technique called deep phenotyping, which means you characterize patients in a very deep level. It's not hundreds of thousands of folks, it's actually hundreds of patients, but they are extensively evaluated in detail along multiple dimensions, regardless of whether they present with a symptom that might look like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or whatever. It's the same battery of evaluation. And the idea is to be able to then not necessarily use the label of the disease to describe that population, but to use data and describe cohorts of patients that might look more like one another, regardless of the disease they come in with. Okay, so it does kind of illustrate several of the major themes that we bring here, which is collaboration, which is team science, big data, and trying to provide a new taxonomy of disease, try to find a new way of trying to look at mechanistic underpinnings of disorders that might look similar or different with the same label, to ideally make it more efficient to define what these clinical cohorts might look like, and more importantly, what they look like over time, how quickly they might evolve. So for example, in Alzheimer's disease, there have been many, many negative clinical trials, only because Alzheimer's is a mixed bag. Yeah. And in fact, their drugs that have been used probably work, but they probably work in a subset. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what is that subset that is most exquisitely sensitive to that particular therapy? Because it's obviously not across the board. And it'll be the analogous thing in Alzheimer's or ALS or others. And how can you actually identify those folks using data techniques rather than the clinical sort of stamp collecting method that we use in clinical medicine?
Okay. Now, one of the big barriers to this kind of approach that I've come across along the way is just this phenomenon in the world today where data has become gold in many ways. And a lot of labs and a lot of academic institutions have a lot of trouble giving up their data. What kind of obstacles have you come across in just trying to get everybody to be open and willing to share all this information that we need?
Yeah, well, so to a certain extent, it's the bit of the power of the purse, right? So you're compelling partners by providing the infrastructure to facilitate this.
Okay.
And I think you also get buy-in of investigators. We know certainly from the cancer field that team medicine is the way you do it. You don't do clinical trials in isolation. You do it as teams, and the clinicians that are involved in folks dealing with these disorders are recognizing the same. Mm-hmm. The data is not investigator data, it's patient data, right? So the idea is, how do you maximize the use of that information in a privacy-compliant way with confidentiality and all the rest of it? But I think if you sat on data sets and preserved you know, security and privacy 100%, no progress can ever happen. So you have to kind of tread the balance there. So we have privacy principles, we have open sharing principles, but also standard compliant to make sure that they're secure.
Okay.
And we've done a lot of work with the hospitals and the institutions to educate them in terms of what sort of security measures we've put into place to maximize the privacy while also ensuring that opportunity to share the data. And I think the only other piece I'll add is that more and more what we're seeing is patients are actually demanding that their data be used in a way that is more likely to impact and shared beyond that actual institution. So the other piece of it is we're seeing more and more patient groups becoming voices and talking to the institutions and talking to the clinicians and saying, we want you to do this with my data. I understand that, you know, my disease is going to impact other people as well. So whatever you can do to help not only me, but everyone as a whole, share the data.
Okay. Now that brings me to my next question. That was simply, what role do patients play in all of this? What can patients be doing to help speed along these new therapeutic advances that we're all kind of looking for?
Right. Well, I think there's several very important ways. At OBI, one of the other sort of founding principles is that patient advocacy and patient engagement into the how research is done is very critical. In fact, there are several even formal programs how patient engagement can actually be ensured and measured so that patient priorities are done into the research realm. So we provide scientists with input directly from patient groups. Each one of our programs has a patient advocacy organization, which often includes folks with lived experience and their caregivers, to provide perspective to make sure that the research is being done is to their best interest. So, but I think there also is a sort of a matter of citizenship. So I think to a certain extent, if you're living in the context of, like we are, in a single payer health system, you receive a benefit of getting your health care, not really for free, it's from taxes. But in any case, though, I think there is, at least they need to be given the opportunity to allow their utilization of the healthcare system to inform the research for, you know, continuous improvement. The way that costs are rising for healthcare, there is no question that innovation is going to be necessary to do things, you know, cleaner, faster, more efficient, and more cost-effective. And that does come from the utilization of health data. And so I think what we want to do is to make sure we're giving patients opportunities to participate by providing not only their data, but also their input as far as research priorities.
Hmm. Okay. Now, I know it's still a very young program in many ways, but what outcomes have you seen so far? And then more importantly, I guess, what do you hope to see in the future from this program?
Well, there have been several very good ones. You know, the other piece we haven't yet talked about is what the role of industry is, what the role of the technology sector. One area, given that healthcare these days is a data-driven enterprise, we have had some excellent engagement with artificial intelligence companies, including IBM Watson, for drug discovery, specifically in Parkinson's, in fact, which is particularly compelling. But we have had other, advances having to look at the shortening the time of diagnosis for a number of different neurologic disorders and the cost savings that are associated with that. But you're right, we're young and we're just basically laying the foundation for, you know, much more significant benefits to come.
I'll add to that, we have also, with Andre, have been able to inform the diagnosis better. For example, this model of studying the different neurodegenerative diseases together via deep phenotyping has informed one participant from one cohort to move to a different one because the diagnosis was able to be informed in that way. Mm-hmm. So having the deep phenotyping embedded into the study means that the participants go through more assessments that they would normally go through, and this would inform the decisions from the clinical perspective.
Are you also actively involved in clinical trial recruitment as well?
Yeah, so there are a couple of angles to that. If you're doing trials with things like Alzheimer's, these are trials that are involving tens of thousands of folks, so we're not actually doing those independently. But each one of our groups is involved in smaller cohort studies to identify early cohorts that might go into larger clinical trials, again, fitting into that international context, being able to not work just as an island, but also be able to contribute elsewhere. So while we don't execute clinical trials only within Andre, what we're going to be doing is providing tactics by which better clinical trials can come in the future. And this phenotyping exercise is the best example of that. So the idea is, if you can identify groups of patients that look more like one another and reduce the amount of variability in a clinical trial, you're going to improve the efficiency of that trial. So this phenotyping exercise is specifically to do that. Let's identify folks that might be presenting with a symptom like dementia, but refine them to a group that looks very much like one another. And what is their trajectory? The more uniform their trajectory is, the easier it is to tell the difference between that group and an effective treatment. If in fact you only have a small subset in a larger population, like in the current Alzheimer's trial, you will lose the impact of any specific treatment in the fog of the larger population.
Yeah, but I guess one of the difficulties that a lot of people face when trying to do something like that is, and this is kind of something you hear a lot in the Parkinson's community, is once you've met one person with Parkinson's disease, you've met one person.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Right.
So developing these subsets becomes a little bit difficult because the lines between one subset A and subset B, for example, will always be a little bit blurry. So how do you just deal with that complexity?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, you know, because you can reduce it, as has been done in cancer, you go from the broad population to categories to very, you know, exquisitely characterized subcategories down to the ultimate end of that is the N of one.
Yeah.
Right? Each person is its own unique little flower. It may well ultimately be the case, but the question is what level of abstraction can actually be informative or valuable?
Yeah.
The N of one trial, these, to be able to show a benefit of a drug in the N of one tells you again, just like the analogy, that you've treated one patient.
Yeah.
And I think in the drug development paradigm that we have is how do you actually get data to know that your intervention is going to be valuable to make accessible in a larger population. So there's a tension back and forth there, there's no question. But there are many, many areas of detail that are necessary to characterize these patients. And you can reduce it to that ultimate conclusion of the N of one is only unique, but that doesn't allow you to generalize, for example, on behalf of the healthcare system about should we approve this drug for the use in whatever disorder. What you can do, though, is to reduce the patients do a uniform enough population where you can actually then show impact in that subpopulation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what that means is that we're dealing not necessarily with, even in Parkinson's, let's say, you're not dealing with all patients who have Parkinsonism, but perhaps a very unique, specific subcohort that might have a certain genetic outcome. Mm-hmm. And maybe that treatment works perfectly fine in that subcohort. What you've then done is reduce the larger population of Parkinson's into a rare disease. So there are a lot of tactics now about approval of treatments for rare diseases that are now being looked at in many cancers because, you know, as opposed to lung cancer, you might have a very defined subcategory, which is quite a rare subpopulation. But if that drug works in that subpopulation, then it's perfectly valid to have that treatment approved.
Would you be able to talk a little bit about those specific Parkinson's subsets that are being developed? I know that there's a lot of work going on in Ottawa, for example, with the GBA cohorts, and there's LARC2 cohorts being developed, I think, here in Toronto as well, but would you be able to give any kind of insight?
Well, I don't think we have enough data to know just yet how uniform those are and how they're characterized over time. Right now, we're still in the characterization phase, I think, of most of those. And besides, there aren't really specific molecular treatments for those specific cohorts, so it is a bit of a characterization effort that has to precede. So now that you've identified that subcohort, then you do that prospective case finding, which of course is also difficult and slow because it's rare.
Yeah.
And then you have to do the temporal exercise. And of course, in these conditions, the rate of evolution is typically slow. So those are slow in coming.
Yeah. Okay.
So we're sort of where cancer was 50 years ago. You know, they've already done all of that, and now they're at a point where they can take that.
They're doing it. Let's not declare victory too soon.
Okay, so there's no victory yet, but they are ahead of the game in terms of this. Where the brain is, we're leveraging a lot of what the cancer field has learned, and hopefully we can implement and deploy it a little bit more quickly. Cancer doesn't have all the answers yet, but we have to sort of move along that pipeline as well.
Well, hopefully it doesn't take us 50 years to get to where cancer is today.
No, that's for sure.
Okay, now the last question that I really wanted to ask, and the part of this that I guess everyone's a little bit, I think, most interested in is, for people here in Ontario, how do you see the future of neurodegenerative diseases and brain diseases in general 10, 20 years down the line? What's going to be different from today to then?
Yeah. You know, I don't think there's any question that we're going to be much more able to create a uniform series of diagnoses so that folks are diagnosed earlier. in the transition towards disease as opposed to established disease. And some of this may well come from, for example, the genomics that are actually starting off in kids being done at birth to identify risk subgroups. I think that's entirely realistic now that the price of next generation sequencing has plummeted so much. I think the value of what the accuracy and the sensitivity and specificity of those is going to come will come in the next decade for sure. And then the practical implementation and deployment into the routine healthcare system will happen certainly within the next decade to follow. Mm-hmm. Right? So we're still in the discovery phase, but I think the pace of innovation has been accelerating. So we're in basically in a really new phase where we haven't been able to kind of swallow what the impact of the rate of innovation so far, but it's going to be accelerating, so we better get used to it. I think we are on the cusp, certainly on the genomic side, of adopting routine genomic testing across the board for all kinds of good reasons, for kids with neurodevelopmental disorders that are avoiding the multi-year diagnostic odyssey before they get into the right bucket. Identify pre-symptomatic folks at risk, looking at and even in those at risk, what are the features that, the exposome and the environmental impacts of how some folks accelerate more quickly towards a disorder versus others, features of resiliency. And this comes from the large-scale study of populations over time. One of the other features we have in Ontario and any single health system is to be able to look at the existence and the temporal evolution of folks living in their communities with their disorders. And ideally, that'll provide data opportunities to mine and identify, are there communities at risk? Are there potentially environmental exposures, educational factors, and stuff like that that feed into the larger data? So it's not going to be all genomics. Not the answer is not going to come just from that, but it's going to come from data. Mm-hmm. I guarantee you that. And so the idea of applying population-based large data enterprises over time is where the benefits are going to come. And it's going to be just a large-scale, messy, dirty mining operation to identify these impactful results in folks living in the real world. Mm-hmm. It's not going to come necessarily from randomized clinical trials that, for the folks that survive to make it to the sub-specialty center. That might be where the first inklings come from, but then it needs to be deployed into the care delivery community. So it's the era of genomic medicine for sure, and that's going to be a significant proportion of identifying folks at risk. And then the at-risk folks can be subject to prevention-type therapies. Those are coming. And the careful deployment of ideally molecularly driven therapies, because we're going to know what the underpinning of some of these disorders is, easily within the decade, and then deployed within the decade to follow.
Okay. Well, that's a bold vision for the future, and I look forward to seeing that become a reality. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you.